Note how difficult it is to establish a form when you do not have enough lines to make the form visible or apparent. This is one of the most difficult aspects of realization. The problems that we have as a questing community are about 1,000 times amplified if you try to do it by yourself. You can do it by yourself, but it's very, very, very difficult to do, simply because the continuity requires such discipline that almost all of your energy and all your time goes into maintaining the discipline. And the popular misconception is that somehow the discipline is what's going on. The discipline is just making available the materia, as it were, for what you you work on. So you can appreciate how difficult this is. And the reason for communities, questing communities, the reason for education in any society is always and everywhere the same: to help establish the wisdom of the people and keep it current, keep it viable, keep it available. And one of the most difficult aspects is to finally recognize that you're dealing with a matrix of dynamics that not only constantly are changing in their own structural relationship, but as you come to new understandings of them, they also change in respect of that. So that if one were to try to map out or diagram, you would come up eventually with the kind of flow process charts that you would get in higher mathematics. It's very similar to that. In fact, higher mathematics is a typical expression of the wisdom tradition. In our particular case, we're hoping at this particular juncture, today and next week, to set a new tone that has not been there before. The new tone is generally referred to as consciousness. Or if you like, because for many of you now, feeling, intelligence, is also consciousness, understood as consciousness. This is a thinking toned consciousness. There's a self-reflection which is in the mind, which is emphasized now, that though it may have occurred before, it was not important to note that it was the synthesizing, I have to use this term, vector. From now on, this whole year, the mind is the synthesizing vector of what we do. And so we have right away a strategic problem to settle for ourselves. And without settling this particular strategic problem, we will spin our wheels inadvertently and get nowhere. The problem is that when you work with the mind has its own structural functioning appropriate to itself, just like the hand has its own functioning. There are some things the hand just cannot do because its structural function doesn't allow for that. The fingertips don't readily bend back and allow you to grasp things backwards. They work by grasping things forward. It's not because the hand is a bad instrument. It's that the structural functioning is not made to work that way, just to put it in colloquial language. The mind can do some things, and what it can do, it does as good as the hand grasping. But the mind cannot do things beyond its structural functioning capacity. The one thing that the mind cannot do, like the hand, it cannot reach back and grasp the self. It is not because the mind is ineffectual and therefore should be dispensed with. It's just simply that its structural function is not capable of bending its fingers back to grasp the self. What it can do, though, it can express and grasp the expressions of the self and hold and manipulate, if you like, or caress and shape, if you like. It can work with and amplify the expressive manifestations of the self. That it can do, and that the mind is made for. The mind is structured in its essentiality to do this. This is its task, its function. In the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu speaks of the mind in characteristic wisdom fashion, that it carries the Tao on its back and embraces the 10,000 things. That is really the function of the mind. It cannot grasp the Tao, but it can carry the Tao on its back, as it were, and grasp the 10,000 things. That it can do. And if we do not require of the mind some impossible, surreal function, we can then learn the working of the mind and train it. And just like we can train the hands, we can train the mind to work at its optimum functioning. It takes a while. And this whole year, this whole second year, is all for the training of the mind through paying attention to the way in which the thinking function, its directionality, its sometimes it's called its intentionality, but the vector of the thinking function is like the point of the arrow of the mind. And wherever the arrow point indicates the mind's functioning, its whole structural relationality tends to move in that direction. So that the thinking function tends to, in its essential operation, it tends to identify. It tends to limit and isolate to the thing itself. It tends to focus. It tends to bring the energies of apperception together into a pointed perception. That one not only sees the letter, but one sees the dots that make up the letter. That kind of thinking-toned point to the intentionality of the thinking function is, as it were, the way in which the mind navigates. And recognizing that is basically common sense. Or, as Bertrand Russell would say, it's such uncommon good sense that we think of it as esoteric. Without the thinking function being directed, the mind is like a wild card. And the sense of chaos that one has comes from undirected images in the mind. And you can promote this in yourself intentionally and discover for yourself that fact. Or you can reflect back on your own life conditions and discover it in any number of incidents. The central experience that the mind cannot grasp, the self, is something that we have paid attention to in the symbols section of this course. I've brought a couple of examples here to show you how in our time, in the late 1980s of the 20th century, how in our time the transformation of the symbolism of the deep self has temporarily made it almost impossible to carry the Tao on our back. We live in a time, in a generation, where the traditional wisdom seems not to work, or to work in such a subtle way that we can almost not believe that it is efficacious. And the reason for this is that over long durations of time, the symbols for the self change. They are not always the same. The self does not change, but the symbols that express the self, that are the self for our experience of it, they do change. And we live in a time where the deep self symbol is changing. Now, this is complicated, and I have devoted all of the Tuesday nights over the last several years to investigating this. And if you get interested, the Tuesday nights relentlessly go into this particular aspect. If you get interested in an expression of it, I refer you to one of our books for this particular series, Alchemical Studies by Carl Jung. I believe it's in paperback, in a Princeton University Press paperback. And I'll come back to it in a minute. But on page 345 of Alchemical Symbols, one of the rare places where Jung lets go of the blinders of his caution, of his carefully engineered defensive posture, and speaks quite openly and quite frankly to the readership. This is in the fifth section of Alchemical Studies, entitled The Philosophical Tree. And this is paragraph 475, if you want to refer to it later on, page 345. He's speaking of a deep archetypal image of an eagle which has come up in a dream, in fact, comes up again and again. And then he writes, assuming that the eagle is an archaic god image whose power a person cannot escape, then it makes very little difference in practice whether he believes in God or not. The fact that his psyche is so constituted as to produce such phenomena should be enough for him, for he can no more get rid of his psyche than he can get rid of his body, neither of which can be exchanged for another. He is a prisoner of his own psychophysical constitution and must reckon with this fact whether he will or no. One can, of course, live in defiance of the demands of the body and ruin its health. And the same can be done in regard to the psyche. He doesn't write it, but he means, and ruin its health. Anyone who wants to live will refrain from these tricks and will at all times carefully inquire into the body's and into the psyche's needs. What are the needs for it to function the way the structure is there to operate? Once a certain level of consciousness and intelligence has been reached, it is no longer possible to live one-sidedly. And the whole of the psychosomatic instincts, which still function in a natural way among primitives, must consciously be taken into account. Now you can Xerox that, you can cut that out, and you can put it up on your refrigerator. Once the threshold of thought has been broached from ever on after that, one has to consciously take into account the functioning of the whole. So that the difficulty is a paradox. When the thinking tone functioning comes into view, comes into operation in such a way that it draws our attention, it is so powerful, it is so effective, that our old unconscious habit of relying on our feeling toned habits to carry us are subconsciously transferred without any realization whatsoever to thought. And then we habitually just let the thought-toned impressions carry us. And one would say, well, this would be an almost impossible thing because there has to be some organization to the thought tones. And in fact, this is true. And were a human being abstracted out of the world, out of society, it would be impossible for them to do this. This is why at the pinnacle of a deep wisdom quest on your own, you cannot go wrong. There's nowhere to go wrong. But if you are living in a world, in a society that has many kinds of crutches, many kinds of false selves, which others are only too glad to loan to you, to have you operate by, then this whole existential paradox does not ever come into view. The whole problem is not only glossed over, but is smeared with a patina of shibboleths and taboos against even thinking that such a thing could occur. And so man and woman are passed into the hands of a false realm just in a twinkling of an eye, and less than that, and never know it. Which is why the characterization of that condition has always been sleep. It means that as wide awake as you can be in this world, you are sound asleep. In terms of the actual existential deep self reality. And in fact, whenever there have been fortuitous, accidental penetrations of that, the shock is enormous, like an electromagnetic storm in a flash. Because the whole thought functioning is in such a way that in terms of reality it was functioning dissociatively. And when you come back to reality, you think that reality is a massive dissociation and experience it as literally the term is loss of self. What you have lost is the false self, but you're sure not convinced that that is the case. If it happens suddenly. So that one has to be alert and be prepared and be strategically intelligent about this, to do this in such a way as to accept the kind of perilous, dangerous qualities that come up from this experience and understand that these are indicators that you're going in the right way. They're not indicators that you have done bad and God's going to kick shit out of you. That's not it at all. They're indicators that you are, in fact, beginning to dissolve the false crutches of a shadow self. And that this is why spiritual courage is really essential. It isn't the power of the ideas. It isn't the beauty of the diagrams that gets you through. It's a kind of integrity that, the old word was, that you trust that this leads somewhere that you can be. So when the thought functioning comes in, when consciousness in the thinking tone function comes into play because of its very structure of orienting to the world in an identity difference fashion, that mode comes to dominate the psychic energy. And one has to counter that by putting it into perspective, by putting it into a larger pattern. But thought is so powerful, it's so effective, that it tends to co-opt whatever is drawn up into its own functioning as the pattern. And this is the egotistical quality of it, that as it gains in power, as it gains in amplitude, as it gains in co-opting everything else, subsuming everything else under its own aegis, its own process, there is only one experience which the mind cannot subsume, and that is the deep self. It can't grasp the deep self. And so the presence of the spirit, I'll talk religiously for a moment with your permission, the presence of the spirit is always the saving grace. It is, in fact, what grace is. It's why grace saves. Not because it's an element of a doctrine of belief, but because it's an existential presence of the divine which you cannot grasp. You can't package it, you can't label it, and it's there whether you want it to be or not. What did Jung have over his front door? Called or uncalled, God is there. And it's an experience which the thinking functioning, if it has not initially from the beginning taken into consideration, begins to consider the experience of the deep self as an adversary, as a demonic non-self trying to intrude itself on its game. And in just this way, the neutral satanic background is foisted by the egotistical mind on the presence of the deep self, and one becomes one's own worst enemy. This condition is properly known as hell. And as the mind becomes more and more able to function with amplitude and power and cleverness, and more objectifies, and that evil becomes personal, it becomes in fact identified, in fact becomes a not-self, a not-person. And there are times in human expression where when they bind between a false egotistical world is juxtaposed with a deep self clarity. There are several examples in human history where this has occurred. It's like having the highest mountain peak next to the deepest ocean trench, and you get a fault zone. And you get, in expressions of the deep self, you get the sparks of the negative cinder figure of the deep self off on the background. I don't have it right handy, but one of the most conspicuous examples of it is in the Book of Kells from the 9th century. And there's a page in the Book of Kells where one has been going into deep self symbols, worlds within worlds within worlds, all unified together. And suddenly one finds in the margin of the text, outside of the page, a burnt stick figure of the devil trying to get in, trying to come in. And it's like a graphic registering in a symbolic visual image, catching in a snapshot on that page the condition that actually occurs and happens. Now, to get into that kind of adversarial self-adversarial mode is the very essence of evil. Because there's no way that the mind can grasp the truth. Its whole structural function is incapable of grasping the truth of that situation. Now, in a popular way of expressing it, it's at a time like that that you have to specifically turn to someone else. Someone else has to tell you. You're doing this to yourself. But note immediately that if you don't trust that other person, if you don't trust their capacities, your immediate impression is that they're working on the other side. So the whole process of trusting another human being comes into play. Now, in the United States, because of the very peculiar spiritual history of the United States, one way to get around that that was developed, the development was called Transcendentalism. And I suppose the center of it was Ralph Waldo Emerson. But Emerson was like the King Arthur of the movement, but Thoreau was like the Sir Lancelot. He was really the operating edge on the thing. But the American Transcendentalist community realized that because it was so difficult to have a spiritual friend, and if you read the Transcendentalist writings on friendship, you realize what a high level of achievement this was. For someone to be your friend, they have to be trusted as you would trust yourself, completely and equally. That there is between true friends a kind of a spiritual exchange of selves. But in lieu of that most peculiar situation, the American Transcendentalists set the tone for the American experience of religion that it's something which the community can do for each other, not just one on one as super friends, but that the community itself becomes a trusting body of confidence for yourself. That the community itself is an interpretive friend which you can trust. Now, this is very, very peculiar. It's not just an American invention. There are antecedents for it archetypally all through history. In fact, the earliest, the Transcendentalists identified it with the pre-church Christianity. They called it primitive Christianity. The Christianity before Paul. What was the Christianity before Paul? Just Jesus. And so it has that kind of a tone. But when it goes back that far, it goes back to, if you are following this, it goes back to a Hebraic sense of community. Jesus' sense of community was Hebraic. And so one is gone back to another dimension which, on an egotistical level in the Christian church, had been seen as a threatening non-self, as a different tradition which should be superseded, and that one's coming back to trust that situation is exactly a regression in terms of the false egotistical realm in which one is living. This, incidentally, is the esoteric origin of anti-Semitism. For the American Transcendentalist, the realization that one has to go back to the interface of whole cultures and civilizations for there to be a community of trust raises the community to a deep self level. Because only there, where there is a community that is not locked into the egotistical habits of the civilizations. Civilizations which are just amplifications of egotistical persons who over long usage, long centuries, have made a style of civilization. Rome, whatever. That the true community emancipates itself from the limitations of historical accident and historical projection and amplification of egotistical individuality, so that one has a very peculiar sense of community. In the 1980s, some 150 years after this, because the nature of the history of ideas, they have a lifetime. Ideas have a lifetime. Their lifetime is about 150 years from the time when some one person has the idea for themselves. It takes about 150 years for an idea to get into its maturity and become common parlance. So that in the 1980s, only in the 1980s, has the maturity of that idea, which was there in the mind of Emerson and in the mind of Thoreau 150 years ago, come finally into a maturity where there is at last a thinking recognition that this is significant, is incredibly significant. Now, I'll give you two examples for this. Do we have enough time before the break, or should I wait? I'll give you two examples of this. The first example is a book published at Mercer University Press in Georgia, 1987. The Community of Interpreters of the Hermeneutics of Nature and the Bible in the American Philosophic Tradition. The author is a man named Robert Corrington. He's a professor of philosophy at Penn State University. Little 100-page book, published 1987. The second book is a little 60-page book, published, I think it's first edition, 1980, by someone who bears the most American name, Jill Wilson. But it has the most un-American title, Chandrakirti's Sevenfold Reasoning, Meditation on the Selflessness of Persons, published in the Library of Tibetan Works in Dharamsala, India. Two Americans, one being published in Macon, Georgia, and one being published in Dharamsala, India. But they speak from the same matrix. There's the same idea which is matured. Both of these are Americans. And both of these, even though they have chosen disparate ways to express it, the one has chosen of an odd kind of cosmic Christianity which seems to be in the air, and the other has expressed it in the most esoteric of all Vajrayana Buddhist realizations. And when you pair them together, like I'll do for you, you can see that their expressions are arcs on the same rim, the center of which is an idea. And the center of that idea was expressed by Emerson and Thoreau originally in the American tradition, but the center of that idea is also the center of the idea that Jung has written about all of his life. And the center of that idea is an experience of the deep self. And the particular quality of the experience of the deep self is that it is imageless. It is empty of images. It is empty of the thrown out objects of inspection which the thinking process would isolate as being rational. And what becomes most rational is a center which cannot be characterized in a point. You cannot point to it. But as Lao Tzu says, every time you point at anything, the presence of that center is there. So it's like the usefulness of a cup is not just the form, but is the space made by the form. The form is all of the functioning which the entire psyche in its functioning makes. But the space made by that functioning is the deep self. And it is the useful part of that vehicle. In fact, just a little emendation here. That's why in this style of Buddhism, it was called a vehicle. Yana, a vehicle. It's called the Mahayana, the great vehicle. And then later on, with these emendations, it was called the Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle. Diamond, not so much because it's hard, but because it reflects, every part of it is a million facets or a billion facets. The object itself is not there. It's only a focus of a million or a billion facets that is there. It's the focus of the facets that are there. So, the Vajrayana. The first example is from Corrigan's book. And incidentally, the book itself is, if you permit me, a little clumsy, because the author doesn't really have a background and tradition that allows him to understand what he's talking about fully. And so it's clumsy in the sense of someone being like a brilliant fifth grader trying to explain college level subject. But occasionally he rises to wonderful levels. The word that he uses for the deep self, he capitalizes with a big E, capital E, and the word is encompassing. And if you get a hold of this volume, this is page 61. He's talking about hermeneutics. Hermeneutics are interpretive modes, in saying that the structure of interpreting modes, the focus of the structure of interpreting modes, are various horizons of sign meanings. And that the sign meanings, when they amplify their referential scope, they like step up in levels. And he has, he calls the first level local, and the second level regional, and the third level provincial, and so forth. There's a geographical metaphor that attends to this. He doesn't express this, doesn't know this particular fact I'm going to tell you. But the reason for this is that the archetypal expression was couched in its misapprehension, not as a person, but as a city. This was done in the 4th century AD. The title of the epic that set all of this into cement, as it were, is called entitled The City of God, not the Person of God, The City of God, by St. Augustine. And wherever the worldly self struggles to express the archetype of the deep self, it invariably falls back in the metaphor of the city. For some of you who are thinkers, there's a brilliant study of Ludwig Wittgenstein's philosophy now, just called City. Well, one can put all of his writings together as if they were quarters and branches of a single city. This was completely unconscious in Wittgenstein. He had no idea. And you can see that it's not, awareness in a comprehensive way is not tied to IQ level. There are very few people that had an IQ as high as Wittgenstein. And I'm sure Corrigan, a very intelligent man, a professor of philosophy at Penn State. But it's not just the thinking function, which is intelligent. The whole self, with all of its functions, is of startling intelligence. And no matter how high your IQ of your thought intelligence, if your feeling-toned intelligence is not balanced with it, it functions as a drag, as a resistance. And what of all the other functions that are there? There are many more than four, incidentally. It's only when they're all brought into play that then one has, how can I express it? Let me use a grandiose phrase. One has an asymptotic IQ. One has an IQ of millions. You literally see your old self as being as dumb as an ant. All of your cleverness was just so much moving a piece of sugar around. That's real humility to see that that was so. The encompassing. So he says that as the dimensions, the amplified dimensions of sign reference increases, there comes a transformational point that the sixth level of sign horizons transforms and is no longer a referential mode, but is absorbed, is subsumed by what he entitles as the encompassing, the deep self. Here's how he writes it. Of the two forms of limitation, serial intersection of horizons of sign of meaning, and the movement towards the encompassing, the latter is rarer and more important to the life of the community. Serial intersection remains on the fifth level of sign function, insofar as it is a movement within the self-transparency of serial ramification. The movement towards the encompassing is the sixth and final dimension of sign function and brings the sign's relation into the sphere of religion. On this sixth level, a sign truly emerges as a symbol and becomes a clearing through which the encompassing exerts its uncanny lure for human existence. We must distinguish between symbols of the encompassing and all other signs if we are to gain a glimpse into that reality that itself is not another sign. Notice how the language is both sweet and confused. It's a sign of youth, spiritual youth. It's sweet. He's close. But it's confused. He doesn't say what he knows. He says as clearly as he can what he supposes. Let's try some more sweet language that comes from this. This is at the bottom of page 63. It's appropriate that he is talking about the symbol of the cross, because his whole referential milieu is that of Christianity. We would call it, without stretching the phrase, fundamentalist Unitarian Christianity, if you can appreciate that kind of a punning type of a phrase. The symbol of crucifixion specifically denies that any human or communal value can be attached to this reality. The cross curiously inverts itself whenever we try to fill it with further human content. In its self-negation, the cross breaks open to that which vastly outstrips human categorical projections. The encompassing is that reality that is revealed through genuine religious symbols. Whether or not the cross is the most radical symbol of the encompassing, it fulfills its role whenever emptiness takes the place of semiotic density. semiotic density as like referential meaning density. Whether or not the cross is the most radical symbol of the encompassing, it fulfills its role whenever emptiness takes the place of semiotic density. This emptiness is not a nihilistic absence of meaning, but a radiant evocation of a different kind of meaning, not circumscribed by the signs of the community and its interpreters. The symbol momentarily